I have a friend whose son is addicted to heroin. I'm John Williams. You can hear me weekdays from noon to 3 here on WGN. And this hour, I want you, my friend wants you to hear his story. About a month ago, my producer Beth Swerk and I sat down with my friend and his wife. You won't hear their names in this conversation, and they will call their son Michael, though that isn't his real name. But they really do live in my neighborhood. Their son went to school with my boys. We live in the comfortable western suburb of LaGrange Park. It's conveniently located between the Eisenhower and Stevenson Expressways. Convenient for us, convenient for drug dealers who have inundated the suburbs around us. The Tribune reported last week that in 2008, officials in DuPage County broke up 16 heroin deals. Last year, it was 59. In Naperville, teen arrests related to heroin use are up 450%. I knew that Michael had been difficult for them, but I never knew exactly to what extent. He didn't go to college after high school, and he had not worked consistently. His brushes with the law had been relatively minor. The jobs he had held kept him in enough cash to finance his habit. He wasn't robbing anyone or any place, as best his parents or the cops could tell. He might have started to fence some household items at the point where this story begins. The story begins just after Michael has gone away, again to rehab last August. So we'll talk about how they got to this place, but mostly we'll talk about how they struggled, how they are struggling to keep him alive and to keep their family from dissolving. It's their hope that if you or someone you know is fighting with addiction, that you will do what they did. And what they did was come to a simple, amazing realization. But that comes later in the story. First, Michael's father talks about getting their son to rehab, this time in Tennessee.
Took my son to the airport on August 8th and took him down to Nashville, Tennessee, where a fine young gentleman picked him up from the rehab facility called The Ranch, a place outside of Nashville, Tennessee. We brought him down there because of his heroin addiction, which we had been dealing with for about a year up to that point.
A little more than a year.
What do you mean dealing with?
We found out.
This was his third time for rehab.
So wait a minute. Third time for rehab. You found out a year ago he's
Correct.
Been in and out of rehab three times.
Yep.
In the last year?
Correct.
Lord, the first time it didn't work?
No. First time was he went up to a place outside of Minneapolis, and which is a wonderful facility. You got to understand that they have to be ready for the message. They have to be ready to accept the fact that they have absolutely hit bottom, and they've got nowhere else to go.
Had your son the first time?
Pardon me?
We thought so.
You thought he was ready. Maybe he thought he was ready. He wasn't ready, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly played all the right cards and said he was ready, because at that particular point of how he went to rehab the first time is when I caught him in his bedroom in the house, and he was coming back from the west side because we had tracked him on his phone. But I caught him with this drug paraphernalia in the basement and just about went out of my mind, of course, and said, you have two choices. You can either leave the house right now or agree to a 30-day rehab facility. And at that point, he said, he thought for about a nanosecond, said, I'll go.
But this is also after he had been into Cook County Jail for the first time. And so we thought for sure, after going through the court process and all that, and him having to deal with the legal issues, that he would be done. And he didn't realize that he couldn't be done.
Right.
So wait, but he goes away then for a month.
Mm-hmm. He does.
Yeah. Does insurance pay for that?
Insurance paid for that one.
Yeah. It's kind of expensive?
Kind of expensive. Certainly is kind of expensive if you don't have insurance. And then the second time he went.
To another place?
To another place.
Another incident precipitated the second visit?
I think his use just continued to escalate.
Or his legal problems.
And his legal problems.
Right. They always went hand in hand.
So he checked into another place.
He checked into another place for 21 days or something.
How'd that go?
That did not go very well. I mean, it was fine for the 21 days that he was there, because he was clean for 21 days. And there was not a chance in hell that he could do that on his own. Not a chance. So it was good in the respect that he was able to detox and get clean for 21 or 22 days, whatever it was. But it's kind of interesting that on the way back from that facility, he was texting one of his friends to talk about buying bags. And bags are an addict's term for the actual heroin baggies. On his way back from rehab.
Did you know that?
Not until later on that evening when we, you know, checked his phone and
it was his computer.
It was his computer at that point. Yeah. Yep.
So what happens with time three?
Time three is, so on August 8th, we send him down there. I'm on a plane with him. And
was there another incident that precipitated the third visit to rehab in a year?
He got behind the wheel of a car and he smashed the car a little bit. He ran into a curb. And we didn't know that he was using again. We had no idea. And when we got home and realized that he was not sober, and so it was after that realization, and then when we saw what he had had in his pockets when he had been at the police station, after just going through a whole legal issue, we knew that it was just too much. He couldn't do it. He didn't want to be a heroin addict, and he couldn't stop being a heroin addict.
And that I'll never forget that particular day because it was the middle of July, really warm day. And I got a call from our second son as we were at like Sam's Club or someplace. And he called and said that my son was at the police station. And so that just shot that day to hell. And truthfully, every time the phone would ring, whether it was not even from my second son, but certainly when it was from Michael, whenever that phone rang, there was a pang of panic because you just didn't know what was going to be behind that the line. When I got the phone call and we were at the store, it was where that panic, sort of that anxiety, just ratcheted up again because he said that Mike was in the police station because my second son went to see him. And said that he was as high as a kite. And I said, he's at the police station and he's high as a kite? He said, yeah, you need to get over here now. So I think we left in pretty much in a hurry and went to the police station where I found Mike in detainment. And he was as high as I have ever seen anybody, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm. It was a huge turning point for
it
us.
Was.
And we're like, he is out of his mind. He doesn't even know how out of his mind he is because he had all the paraphernalia, everything in his pockets. When I got home, he was passed out. Everything was right there. That's when we said, you're going.
To another facility, now Yes. This is time number three.
This is time number three.
Okay.
But at this point, too, we were working with a therapist, and she knew about the ranch in Nashville, and she knew our son. So she put the two of them together and said this would be a good fit. And she was afraid if we waited any longer that he would be dead. We actually didn't even want to send him there because we were done.
Right. We were.
We were.
What do you mean you were done?
Well, we were like, you know what? You're 21.
This is your life.
Figure this out.
These are your decisions that you're making. And we had been dealing with the heroin use for about a year, but we had been dealing with other issues, other legal issues, and other drug-related issues for probably the past 3 years prior to that.
So you're exhausted.
So we're exhausted. We're just taking body blow after body blow.
And I don't want to dwell on this, but I mean, does the financing of the treatment, because my understanding is it can be very expensive, does that ever enter into your equation?
Well, this one was.
This one, absolutely.
Because it was private. And we said, when our the therapist told us how much it was, we said, we laughed. We thought she was joking at first.
Yeah.
And it didn't go through insurance. And but yet, when we were contacting places that the insurance did take, mm-hmm. they just didn't seem to be obviously as good. And this is the first time we had someone who knew our son, who knew the treatment and said, this is going to work. And she said, if you don't do it and he dies, your other sons
yep.
will be very angry with you because you didn't do it a third time. You didn't do it the last time. You didn't make that judgment. This is it. And our son even said during our family weekend, if I relapse, cut me loose. And that's exactly what we wanted. Right. We wanted that end.
Yep.
One more time. And it was, we'll be paying for it for a long time.
And that's one of the things that really sort of struck me when we were talking to the therapist. Her name is Paige Turner, and she's in Hinsdale, Illinois. She probably saved his life and certainly saved our lives. From an emotional perspective. I mean, she was a godsend. I mean, she really was. So I remember sitting in her office and talking to her about this, and I was furious. I couldn't hardly think anymore because of what my wife and I have gone through and what we have tried, air quotes, what we have tried to do to, quote again, save him, and he wasn't responding to the fact that we wanted to, again, save him. So many times over and over. And the fact that this was going to cost us X amount of money, which I would pretty much have to wipe out my 401k to pay, I would have none of it. And that's when we had the conversation with her, and she said, you might want to rethink that. I know you guys are so angry right now, and we were so angry. She said, but you have to think about it this way. You have to think about it from your other son's perspective. If this goes down, and it is going to go down badly, and by that, I mean, he will be dead in a short amount of time. Your sons are not going to blame him. They are going to blame you for not taking that last stand to try to save him, to try to keep him alive. And so that's when we said, okay, this is an addiction. This is a disease. And it's as if he had diabetes or a form of cancer that wasn't going to be covered by insurance. What would you do? Guess what? You're going to find the money to try to keep him alive. And that's what we did. That's what we did in the end. And it saved his life.
So what was the weekend like then? So you took me to the airport in Nashville, right?
Yep.
But did you all fly down and do the family weekend right away? Or you sent him there for a while and then eventually did a follow-up yourself? And how long was he down before you caught up with him in his treatment regimen?
Was it a month?
About a month.
About a month.
Had you had any contact with him in that month?
Phone.
On the phone. Not for the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, which was such a relief.
Which was a relief. It was a
really?
Huge relief.
Why do you say that, Linda?
Because we didn't have to worry. And then we found out actually afterwards that he had just gotten a new tattoo, had gone into a river and got MRSA.
Right.
MRSA. Mm-hmm. And all that happened. He was in the hospital and he, you know, all this stuff happened. And we were never called. And it was such a relief.
It was.
That we went 2 weeks without having
because
to worry
about
his...
Because you have to realize that going through this insanity... You are on 24/7. It doesn't stop.
For months, for years.
For years. For us, it was, I think it was 3 years of the period that I come up with. And I'm saying, the phone rings, you have no idea what's on the other end of it. You're constantly in this, you get into an addict dance, and the addict dance is a codependent, enabling behavior that you and the addict feed off each other. What we did, and this is not unusual per se for this particular disease, is you check his email, you check his phone records, you check his Facebook log. I knew all his passwords into his stuff, and I tried to control every possible situation. We had his phone, had a GPS on it, so we knew where he was. And you think that you can control him, that you can control his actions, just like I think I can control which way the wind is going to blow. You can't. And so once you have that sort of literally, come to Jesus or whoever your Jesus is, that's when it changed, and that's when it changed for us.
So what was that weekend like then when you finally caught up with him a short time later, a couple weeks later?
He looked unbelievable. After 30 days of being clean, it was – he looked like our son, and it was wonderful to be with him. It was because he was so happy. This was the place. He was getting it. He was doing a lot of work, and he was really there was a lot of emotional times because we had some sessions over the phone. I actually told him one time that I had to go to a funeral for a young woman who was killed in a car accident, and I told him that as I was sitting at the wake, I was just totally amazed that it wasn't his wake. That it wasn't his funeral, because I thought every time I'd come into the house, I thought I would find him dead. And it was the first time that he actually understood that. And he got really emotional over that because he really thought about it. Whereas before, he would say he's going to think about it. But as an addict, they don't.
When you saw him after these 30 days, how did it feel different from that first round?
Well, the first and the second round?
And the second.
Those days, we said, you can leave after 28 days or after 30 days. This one, we said, you know what? We're not putting a date on this. You can, you know, we'll see how we can finance this, but you're staying until they tell you that you're ready to go. And so I think part of his thing was he didn't have that kind of that pressure of, okay, well, I got to get out of here. He knew too, once he was able to figure it out, you know, once he was sober, he knew that this was it. This was his last chance.
Yep. We drove down there. We get there Friday evening, I think it was. And I'm still at the point where I am really just angry about the whole situation. I'm still angry, still full of rage over the past 3 years and what it's done to our relationship and just the craziness, the insanity, the vortex that we've been sucked into. So I'm going down there thinking, you know, my back's up against the wall. I said, screw it. Okay, I'll do this for whatever reason. I'll do it. I had very low expectations, but I wanted to do it just to sort of like throw in the last towel that I had to see if it was going to work. And I remember sitting in the first meeting we had Friday night, and the whole weekend's called the family of origin, where you come from and how you are raised and your family, the DNA and all that stuff. The family tree is really important. Another part of the overall sort of purpose of that weekend was very introspective. And you have to remember that when you're in a situation with an addict, there's no time for introspection. You are throwing everything you have at that addict to sort of try to either keep him alive or to, you know, just make sure that he doesn't kill somebody else by driving a car or whatever it might be. Because you have to think about it, I think about it anyway, as sort of like a house. And your house has a number of different rooms. And my wife and I have a bedroom, and the other kids have a bedroom. He has a bedroom. Every dollar that we had to spend to sort of redo the rooms, every dollar that you have goes into that addict's room. The other rooms don't get any money. They don't get any time. They don't get any attention, including our own. So again, that's the whole part that you there's no time for introspection at all. And I thought one of the greatest things about that weekend was it really was all about introspection in a big way. You thought about sort of what your part in this was and how do you want to change? Because as we've said in our house, nothing changes if nothing changes. I mean, something has to be different.
The first night was all about really a lot of facts.
Yep,
the
physiology
really,
really helped me a lot as far
about
as
trauma.
Understanding trauma. There's big T and there's little T. Big T, as far as the trauma is concerned, would be sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse. Those are big traumas. Little T's are events that happens in everybody's lives that affect you one way or the other in an emotional way. And those are the little T's. And those together all add up to sort of the emotional pain that the addict keeps trying to push down. And it keeps trying to come up. They keep trying to push it down. And because it's so painful for them, that's when whatever the drug of choice comes into being. But for me, that night was important because it was the first time that I sort of understood, as my wife said, sort of the facts about addiction, the physiology about addiction, the emotional response that's related to addiction. And I remember sitting there, distinctly remember sitting like there was yesterday, and I was sitting back in the chair with my arms folded, just like this. And then as the night wore on, I sort of started leaning forward and just hanging on every word that these counselors were talking about, because I was thinking, this is what I've been dealing with exactly for the past 3 years, and it's finally sort of making sense to me.
Why? Because there's some of it that you think, this isn't a disease, this
right.
is a behavior, this
right.
is a
Correct.
Choice.
Yep. Right.
So where are you on that?
It's a disease. It's a physiological...
But isn't it one that you volunteer for? I mean... an alcoholic doesn't become an alcoholic until they decide to have their first or too many beers, right? I mean, did you think about it in those terms? Did they talk about that?
They certainly talked about that, and I thought about that before I went there for that weekend. And what I came away with is that the brain chemistry of someone who is sort of predisposed to addiction is different than yours or mine. And once they start adding the chemicals into that already sort of misaligned synapses and everything else that goes on, it just wires it even farther away from where it quote-unquote should be. So it is, at least in my mind, absolutely a disease, and one that has to be treated. And it's a disease that ends badly. It either ends in jail, death, or homelessness.
Well, who else? Go ahead.
Even if it ends in jail, because we know, you know, some of his friends who detoxed in jail in Cook County.
Yep.
And came out clean and started using again.
So what was day two? The second day and a transformative third day are in the second half of their story. Again, I'm John Williams, and my friends are taking us on their trip off Chicago's heroin highway. They approached me about doing this broadcast in the hope of helping others. A complete podcast of this broadcast is at WGNRadio.com on the John Williams page. A list of resources for addicts and their families is also at WGNRadio.com on the John Williams page under links and information. We'll pick up on the second day after this. So now part two. I'm John Williams, and this is a conversation friends of mine asked to have so that you might hear how one family in Chicago is fighting the battle of their lives with their son's heroin addiction. Michael is not his real name, but the rest of this story is, to too many families, quite familiar. After two trips to rehab in 1 year, the family makes one final stand, sending their son to the recovery ranch outside Nashville, Tennessee.
Well, they gave us a homework assignment on Friday night. And the homework assignment was that you are going to come back tomorrow and, again, about the introspection. There was – everybody got a piece of paper, and they had three columns. The left-hand column, it said regrets. The middle column was requests, and the right side of that piece of paper was appreciations. The next day, that Saturday, you are going to talk about your regrets with your loved one, with your addict. You'd ask for requests, and then you would talk about appreciations. You know, I appreciate your laugh. I appreciate your smile. I appreciate you when you made me chicken marsala, whatever it might be. So that's what Saturday was.
Did Michael have the same assignment?
Yes, he did.
But they were freaking out about it. He and one of his guys, they were like, I said, why are you guys freaking out about this? We're just going to, you know, I thought it was an individual session. And with the person, one of the people that was running it. And it was actually, they
like
divided.
Like just your family, you mean?
Right. They divided this group of 20 or so into two. And so we had a circle around. And then in the middle was the addict and his people, and then the therapist.
You get in this inner circle and you see the other 30 people around you. But what's interesting is as you start to talk about your own family situation, about your regrets, requests, and appreciations, everybody melts away. You don't even know they're there. I mean, that's
until you hear other people crying.
Right. True.
So you were doing this in front of people that, even though they had the same thing, you'd never met them.
But the thing that I really remember about that particular day is when you walked into the room was wood paneled. It almost looked like a lodge. It had high beam ceilings. The lights were really low. It smelled sort of like juniper and rosemary. It was a real sort of nice, calming, serene feeling when you walked into this room. I also remember in that inner circle where the four chairs were, or three chairs, depending on how big your family size was, there was also a bowl. I think it was a bowl with three candles in it. And the candles represented, as the counselor said, the candles represented a vacuum. Especially when you talked about your regrets. The regrets were to go into that vacuum and go away. The whole idea was to get rid of them, to be done with them. Because you're carrying these regrets around for 20 years, whatever it might be.
So what were the regrets?
My regrets were, I remember that first one, because I had carried it with me for 20 years, which was, I regretted that I never built him a treehouse. And it sounds like, didn't build a treehouse. Well, he had a playset, whatever it might be. But the reason is that's so important is I promised him I'd build him a tree set.
You promised to do something, and you didn't do it.
Yeah, didn't do it. So what the message to him is, I don't matter. Mm-hmm. The message to him is, you promised me, the father figure, the father, said to you are going to build me a treehouse, and you didn't do it. the message is, I don't matter. It's the same thing as when mom or dad said, I will be at your ball game tomorrow. Bet on it. And Jimmy or Jill is looking up from the baseball diamond, looking for mom and dad. They're not there. What's the message? Message is, I don't matter.
What were his regrets?
I regret that you ever saw me high. I regret that you ever found needles in the house. I regret, you know, there was, he had more of that drug. Mm-hmm. And I think from what we had learned on Friday night about traumas and just how somebody doesn't feel safe. And it's not that you do something on purpose to make them feel unsafe, but that little things that you don't pick up.
I wonder if, go back to the tree fort. Did he remember that? Did
yes,
that bother
did.
Him?
Oh.
Had you talked about that before?
Well, we didn't really talk about it.
Joked about it.
We joked about it.
But that was painful for him.
Yeah.
And you didn't realize maybe did that this was something the two of you had been carrying around all this time.
Yep.
Well, not me.
What does that have?
Just him.
Yeah. What does that have to do with a drug addiction? How does that?
Oh,
relate?
Well, you know what? Besides the treehouse, also the fact that what happened to him in second grade when a teacher made reference to one of his works and then threw it away.
Well, she ripped it up in front of the class.
A class assignment.
Yeah, in second grade. And that really, I mean, that was so hard for me to listen to because we knew something was going on and we knew that there was a lot of tension with this teacher. But in second grade, and I just think that that's amazing that that much trauma could happen.
Wait, did you know the story? Were you hearing this for the first time about him being traumatized by
yes.
getting it? But all right, so your son went through this trauma in second grade, and it's bothered him all these years.
Yeah.
And he didn't share that with you. Really liked that all along, did he?
And I don't think I don't even know if he knew that it was a trauma.
Well, then what does that have to do with him being a drug addict? How does the tree fort or the assignment story relate to him being a drug addict today?
The feeling like he's different. Like he would wake up, and that certainly happened when, you know, this teacher did this in second grade, or when that he would wake up and he didn't feel normal. Because if he was normal, then his father would have built him a treehouse, and his teacher wouldn't ripped up his, you know, if he was good, if he was normal, none of that stuff would have happened. And the thing is that when you deal with someone who's an addict, they will look you right in the eyes and say, the reason I'm having problems has nothing to do with the fact that I want to get high. They have really no idea because it just doesn't seem like it. It seems like they just want to get high. But there is so much more behind that.
So I guess you can either label that a cop-out. Hey, we've all had problems in our lives, or embrace it and address it, huh?
It would be nice if they could just do a little blood test when they're born mm-hmm. to say, oh, you know what? This one might just be an addict. Maybe an alcoholic coming. You know, this is what you can do. And it would be a lot easier for people to understand that this really is something that they can't control if a blood test would come up positive for something.
So were you coming around on day two?
Day two was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. It really was. It was transformational.
What was day three like?
Day three was also pretty heavy. The counselors just told us to come and wear comfortable shoes because you may be walking outside. Well, you know, you walked outside for about 2 minutes, and what they did was they had everybody line up, and this was all 40 of us, and you put blindfolds on. It was a beautiful day in September, about 85 degrees, a nice breeze blowing. You put the blindfold on, and then you were to put your hands on the person in front of your shoulder, and then person back of you put their hands on your shoulder, and they walked you around slowly, sort of serpentined, you know, left and right. You had no idea where you were. So you knew you were outside, but then you knew you were inside, but you had no idea which building you were in or what it looked like. And they said, today we are going to do an exercise called the rope maze. And the object, the end game of the rope maze is to find the exit.
You're blindfolded now. You walk in, and now you got to find your way out of this maze.
Right. And, and there's some rules too.
And there are ropes. You can hang on to the rope. You cannot speak.
You can't let go of the rope.
You can't let go of the rope. And that way, you feel around to see if there's a door, or you've just got to find your exit.
You don't know what the exit is.
No.
You just know that you have to find the exit, right? And for me, I said, okay, well, I can do this. again, it's, you know, it's nice and quiet in there. You're not supposed to talk. If you had a question for the counselors, you were to raise your hand, and then the counselor would come up and whisper in your ear and talk to you, right? So those are sort of the basic rules of what we were dealing with.
So all you got to do is just figure out how to get out of the maze.
Yeah.
Blindfolded.
Blindfolded, yeah. Right. So. For me, I remember, you know, putting my hands one in front of the other, feeling the rope, going, I can do this. I've managed pretty well throughout my life. I put myself through college. You know, I've climbed the corporate ladder. I've done everything myself. I can game this system because I've done it all my life. So I remember feeling the ropes, and one of the ropes was sort of skinny, and then there was a turnbuckle, and you could go left or right, and one of the ropes was fatter. So they had different feelings to it, different tactile feelings of the ropes. And I remember getting to this one point where there was – I thought there was a window – and I thought this was sort of the end of the rope. Now, actually, I'm 25 minutes into it at this point. And up to that point, within the first 5 minutes of everybody at the same time going through the rope maze, you hear one of the counselors sort of clapping his hands and go, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome this fine young woman home because she has found the exit. We're going, okay, awesome for her.
It's here.
It's here. Yeah. The exit is here.
We're
somewhere.
We're going to find it.
We're going to find it. So you go on for another couple minutes. You hear some more clapping. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome this fine young man home. He has found the exit. I go, okay, this can be done. Another 20 minutes goes by. I'm starting to get a little hot, a little hotter under the collar going, I'm not figuring this out as quickly as I thought I was going to figure this out. So I get to this one point. I put my hand up there thinking, this is the exit. So I go, raise my hand. Counselor comes over. He goes, you know, how can I help you? And I said, I think I found the exit. And he goes, no, what do you need from me? I said, I've found the exit. He goes, no, you have to continue.
And then he left.
And then he left. And
you
he
two
walked.
Are separated.
Just
you two in. Are yeah. not together.
We're not together.
So you're doing the same
Everyone's
thing he is.
On their, we're in the same room, but we're all
on
alone.
Yep.
Because I did the same thing. I stopped. I was so frustrated. And I stopped and said, okay, this is exactly how I felt when we're trying to do everything for our son. We had no clue. We're just going gung-ho. Let's just try to find something. And so I raised my hand. I said, okay, so this is my exit. Just in the middle of nowhere, just by saying it's my exit, it's my exit. And he said, no, that's not it either.
Right.
So you're still working the rope.
So I'm still working the rope maze and just getting a little bit more agitated.
As is our son.
He's doing it too.
He's doing it too.
So everybody's doing it.
Everyone's doing it.
40 or 50 people are in this room trying to find the exit, right? And again, every couple minutes you hear the clapping. Let's
and
welcome this fine young woman.
You
kind of want
to go over there to say, oh, right. Well, we're okay. Yeah. So if they're over there, then maybe we'll go. Maybe the exit's over there.
And I did that too. Oh, I tried to find my way over to where you hear, and you hear it sort of all over the place. You get so confused. And so after I was doing it for probably 40 minutes, I think, and I just got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. So I stopped. I thought I had found the exit, but I was just at this point was literally at the end of my rope. And I raised my hand, and the counselor came over, and they whisper in your ear, and he goes, how can I help you? I said, I need you to give me a clue of where the exit is. And he said, that's what you want. What do you need? And I thought about that for a second. I said, okay, I need you to help me find the exit. He said, that's what you want. What do you need? And I'll never forget this. My shoulders dropped, my head dropped, and I raised my hand and said, I need help. And he said,
yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome this fine young man home. So the message here, because we've been there. Don't be afraid to raise your hand because you cannot do it alone. And that's sort of the insanity of dealing with an addict is that you keep trying to do everything yourself. You keep trying to control a situation that is uncontrollable. You try to manipulate the system as much as you can and think you're going to win. You are going to lose every single time. And by losing, I mean that addict will die.
When I took my blindfold off, both my husband and my son had already come out of the maze. I was probably the biggest enabler, I guess. So I kept on thinking I could do it. And I took my blindfold. I didn't take it off. The counselor did, and I wasn't expecting it to come off. And there's my son with open arms next to my husband saying, welcome home, Mom. I thought, this make sense to me. That was my biggest. That was huge for me.
And there were people who, when they finally sort of, when you finally get it,
oh,
they're breaking down, crying on their hands and knees, because it's such a powerful moment when you say, I can't do this alone. I don't have to do this alone, and I shouldn't do this alone. There's a lot of other places and a lot of other people who are willing to help you get through this sort of crawling from the wreckage and coming out of that insanity.
So where are you now?
We're at a good place right now.
Our son
has been clean for 6 months, which is the first time in, I don't know, 5 years maybe. He's living in a halfway house.
How old is he?
He is going to be 22. He's working.
How much longer did he stay at the ranch after you left?
Another month.
So he's working. He's doing well.
He came home for the first time in the holidays, and he's completely sober. And our holidays were
fantastic. First
something,
time.
Yeah, it was like something we hadn't experienced before. And mainly it was just a lack of tenseness, mm-hmm. tension.
Right.
You're not nervous about him using again?
Well, you are. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. He certainly could relapse. But where we're at now with our own recovery, because you are completely affected by it. You are part of that addict's life, obviously, but you're part of the insanity of it, and that insanity affects you in so many different ways, so many different ways. So we finally made the decision to get healthy as far as dealing with the addict like we had been doing before. I mean, to be perfectly honest, we were probably the codependent enablers of the year. I mean, if there was an award for it, we would have gotten it, because we did everything, every classical step you could do to enable and have a codependent relationship with the addict, we did.
Why do you say that?
Because we did it.
Like what? Give me an example. I mean, you were the ones that were checking the phone records. You were the one that had the GPS. You were the ones who were working on it.
And right. And those things, he shouldn't have had a phone. And if he was using, he shouldn't have been in our house. And I mean, there's so many things that you look back on. The thing with a heroin addiction, though, is I wonder how many times we saved his life. Because if he didn't have a phone, we wouldn't have been able to. I mean, there's just so, it's just one thing leads to another. And do you save his life? Well, if you're going to save his life, well, then he's going to keep using. You know, it's especially with heroin, there is death. That's it. That's what you're saving him from.
But at a certain point, you have to realize, again, because that's part of our own recovery, realizing that you cannot control his actions. I cannot save him. He has to want to make the right decision. And you cannot control that. As powerful as you think you are, it ain't going to happen. So if he wants to use again, if he feels that need again, and he does,
that's his gig.
That's his gig. That's his decision. And as we sort of laid out during that family weekend, and he said it directly to us, if I fall down again, don't lift me up.
Cut me loose.
And you have to respect that. You have to respect the dignity of him as a human being to say, you will rise and fall on your own.
But he has enough sobriety behind him in just the, you know, the minutes of sobriety that he has right now to say to me, I would never, I don't want to use now. The consequences of me using are so negative and so heavy. It's not something that I want to do, which is something he never thought of before.
His decisions now are, I need to buy food.
He has to go get food stamps.
He had to pay a food stamp.
He's got to get a job. I mean, he's had to do this all on his
own.
And that's a huge accomplishment for him.
Yeah. I mean, we are so proud of him and how far he's come and for what he's doing right now. It's remarkable.
In our neighborhood, we're so close to the heroin highway. There's too many funerals.
In the western suburbs of Chicago, yeah.
One, the first time that he was in Hinsdale Hospital emergency room, the doctor said, you wouldn't believe how many people I pronounced dead from this, in this hospital. Another friend had gone to LaGrange and had OD'd and then brought back to life. And the nurse had said three people had died the past week from heroin.
There are seven kids in our son's class over the past 2 years that have died from heroin overdose.
High school class?
High school mm-hmm. class.
In his high school class?
In his high school class.
He went to a big school, but kids in his high school class
correct.
That he knows of yep. have died of heroin.
Correct.
Yeah.
Heroin is easy to get.
It's cheap.
It's cheap. It's $10 for what they call a bag. It's a little tiny little baggie. It's cheap. It's plentiful. It's pure.
It can be delivered to your house if you want it.
It can be delivered to your house.
Are you mad at the people that were helping you?
Mm-hmm.
Who he's buying it from?
West Side, big time. Mm-hmm. That's where the heroin highway leads to.
The heroin highway is 290, and the reason they call it that is because it goes right from the western suburbs all the way to the west side.
But you guys are optimistic?
We just got to take it one day at a time.
You do. You literally do.
This past day has been a great day for him. That's what you do.
Yep.
And I really hope tomorrow will be too.
One of the things that you learn going through recovery, the serenity prayer. If we were to teach that to our grade school children, along with the Pledge of Allegiance, this world would be at a much better place. Because the serenity prayer is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Michael today is alive, clean, and well. Did you hear his mother's reaction when I asked them if they worry about a relapse? She sighed the sigh of a mother who has thought about that a lot, but has resigned herself to knowing that this is something she cannot control. Now on his own, Michael is renting a room from a friend, out of state, away from his old haunts. He has a job. He and his parents are taking things one day at a time. And they really believe that they would not be in this place if they didn't come to the realization that they cannot control their son's actions. That is not to say that they should not try to help him, but it is also consistent with their belief that helping him was something that they could not do alone. They needed help, and it was okay to ask. The list of support agencies for addicts and their families is at WGNradio.com. Go to the John Williams page. It's under links and information. A podcast of this broadcast is there, too, on the John Williams page at WGNradio.com.